Okay, well, hello and welcome to Making a Killing, episode 33. This is the podcast from Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative about how corruption is reshaping global politics. I'm Nate Sibley, your host as always. I'm joined by co-host Paul Massaro, and also today by our Hudson Institute colleague, Peter Rao. He's a senior fellow at Hudson and a US foreign policy expert who has a strong sort of research focus on Europe, which is great because no prizes for guessing what we'll be discussing today, and that is the situation in Ukraine and what options are available to US and Western policymakers to hopefully deter, but if not hold accountable, Vladimir Putin's regime for any further attacks that it may make on Ukraine. I should say that Peter had a really insightful discussion on this at Hudson Institute this week that goes into far more detail than we'll probably have time to do here on the podcast today. So if you're interested in digging deeper, do head over to hudson.org afterwards. And he also had a great op-ed in the New York Post just in the past 24 hours, really setting out all the issues that we'll be looking at in more detail today. But we, as you know, our focus on Making a Killing podcast is primarily with the economics of authoritarianism, so transnational corruption and kleptocracy, and how these sort of create and exacerbate so many of the other threats that we face in the world today, emanating from authoritarian regimes. But as these ideas move to the more to the mainstream of US foreign policy and national security thinking, do the measures we have to counter them have any place in confronting Putin over Ukraine in situations like this? And if so, how do they fit in a broader strategy? And if not, what are those other options that we should be looking to constrain Putin's malign behavior? It is a fast-moving and sort of complicated situation. So for reference, if you're listening, we're recording this at about lunchtime, DC time, on Thursday, January 20th. If Putin invades tonight, and this usually goes out the day after, then the morning after. So, you know, you might want to sort of skip ahead in that case. But I guess, so welcome to the podcast, Peter. It's great to have you on for the first time. And I wonder if you could just sort of kick us off by, you know, very basically and very sort of quickly, why is this happening now? You know, it's sort of caught a lot of people off guard. Suddenly there are 130,000 Russian troops have appeared on Ukraine's eastern border. And how would you sort of rate, you know, what has the Biden administration's approach been so far to the situation?
Well, for starters, thanks for having me on what I think is the best named podcast out there in the national security space. So it's great to be with both of you. As for the immediate reasons why this crisis is taking place right now, I would say it has something to do with the winter months. It's no secret, although the Russian military is an all-weather military and it could conduct major operations in the springtime, the frozen tundra of Ukraine is better for mechanized action than, say, the slog that the Russian forces would face if they were to move in the spring. And in the winter months, Europe is especially vulnerable to coercion on the natural gas front. Of course, Europe is something like 40% to 43% dependent on Russian natural gas for its heating. And so Putin may calculate that if he goes in and the Europeans, together with the United States, implement or levy large-scale sanctions, that he can threaten an energy cutoff to try to coerce them into backing down, or just to blunt the scope and scale of those sanctions. More broadly, though, I think Ukraine is an enticing target for Vladimir Putin. He wrote an important piece, which I would commend to all of your listeners, last summer on the historical unity of the Ukrainian and Russian peoples. This is sort of the ideational constructivist argument for why not only Ukraine, also Belarus, is part of this condominium of Russia, and why it should be united under the umbrella of Moscow. So it matters a lot, I think, in the Putin sort of historical telling, and it also matters if one just takes a classic realist attitude and reads the map. I mean, Ukraine has a large Black Sea coastline. Russia is always looking for warm weather ports, and so a presence on the Black Sea, which it of course has, not only with Russian territory proper, but also since the annexation of Crimea. Adding to that, blocking Ukraine from the Black Sea doesn't quite turn it into a Russian lake, but does help expand and connect up his military strategy with the ports he has developed in Latakia and Syria on the Mediterranean. So it's part of a broader military move. And then lastly, and I think this is fairly obvious for anyone who's been watching the United States trying to get a handle on this, Ukraine sits outside of NATO. And so the US does not and has been unwilling to make the same military guarantees to Ukraine that it would make to, for example, the Baltic states or Poland. So I think those are some of the reasons why Ukraine in particular and this moment in time is the crisis we're watching in Europe.
It's a fantastic overview, and it sort of mirrors something that, you know, I think as well, you know, I think, you know, when Putin's regime started, I think very much about basically outright larceny, you know, his power base was the oligarchs, and they were allowed to go out and steal whatever they wanted. That was very much his focus. But over time, you've seen, you know, it shift to more of a sort of ideological make Russia great again type thing. And he's personally, you know, he now has this huge security apparatus beneath him, which is personally loyal to him. And he derives much more of his power base from them. So he's able to sort of think, or is thinking more about, you know, these sort of geopolitical things rather than, by all accounts in his early years, how to sort of hand out the spoils of the Russian economy. But Paul, sorry, I just wanted to turn to you because I know you've been tweeting furiously this week about why this is kind of not just, you know, that, you know, a strategic consideration for Putin, but also the results of a sort of failure to confront strategic corruption that the Kremlin has been spreading throughout Europe.
Well, that's right. And I guess, you know, I want to second everything Peter said. It's all extremely important. And of course, you know, I come at that from a different perspective because I'm so focused on the economics and the finance of this. I mean, to me, a lot of this constant cycle of escalation and de-escalation that Putin gets into, and, you know, I think it's important to recognize that this is not even the first time, you know, in this administration that we've seen a massive escalation, troops on the border, and then a de-escalation. And a lot of this is how Putin intends to keep his regime running. And this is part of, like, understanding to me the ins and outs of kleptocracy, and that's to say Putin needs to do two things that are very, very difficult. It's to walk this tightrope. And that is, one, he needs to convince the Russian people that NATO is a threat always, that he needs to have that foreign enemy. And then two, he needs to somehow also maintain open access to the West, because that's kind of his deal with the oligarchs. Is you don't have to live here, you don't have to live in this dingy, you know, country we've created. We're looting Russia. We're not investing in it. You can take all the money to the West and live there. But the West also needs to be the enemy. So these sorts of things, this kind of dichotomy is very, very difficult to maintain. And I think that this is a further expression of that. That, you know, the economics haven't gone very well for Putin for all sorts of reasons. You know, the ruble's collapsing, the economic situation is a mess. Russians, we've seen greater repression in Russia than we've seen since Soviet times by a mile. Foreign agents laws and, you know, this foreign agents law, of course, has nothing to do with the Foreign Agents Registration Act of the United States. They try to draw that parallel, but it has nothing to do with it. It's essentially, if you get labeled a foreign agent, you get thrown out of the country, which is what's happened to all Russian dissidents, pretty much. And a lot of the civil society operating the country. And then, of course, Alexei Navalny, who's been imprisoned for a year, and so on and so forth. So Putin's scared. I mean, at the end of the day, it seems to him like his regime is in a tough spot. Like, you know, the corruption that has underpinned it is finally being exposed. Finally could get him in trouble. So he needs to create that enemy image. So that's kind of, to me, what's gotten us here, to this kind of like brink, you know. And that's really very unfortunate. I think it could have, first of all, we should have been doing stuff over the last 30 years, you know, but okay, we didn't, you know, we took the money and everything. And that's kind of the strategic corruption element, Nate, to me, is how we've ended up having a lot of officials that have in the West, not, you know, not necessarily in the United States, but certainly in Europe, where Gerhard Schroeder, you know, former German chancellor, now works for Putin. François Fillon, former French prime minister, works for Putin. Karen Kessel, you know, former Austrian prime minister, works for Putin. You know, and the list goes on, right? I mean, these are high level, but there's so many of them. And because of that, we have this divided West that, well, you know, Russia's still an important economy or wherever, and we shouldn't do this or that or the other thing. We want to keep these. So we're stuck in this kind of path dependency as this goes on.
I would just add on to that. It struck me as you were talking that paradoxically, the structure of the Russian economy, despite its decline, allows Putin to project power outwards, because rising inequality in country and this collection or concentration of wealth in a narrow oligarchy surrounding Putin means that those officials travel abroad a great deal, and they give the impression that Russia is thriving because as they've concentrated wealth, they've been able to deploy that wealth around Europe. I have a friend, my mother is Austrian by birth, and so I grew up in part, since you mentioned Karen Kneisel, in Austria, and I have a great affinity for the country. And I was speaking to an Austrian friend a year or two ago, and he said to me, you can barely walk around Kitzbühel, which is this fashionable ski resort in the Tyrolean Alps where there's a famous ski race every year, but you can barely walk around Kitzbühel without hearing Russian anymore. And the Russians have bought out a great deal of what is some of the most valuable real estate in Western Europe. I don't know how much truth there is to that, but it's certainly true, as the German defense minister mentioned recently during one of her maiden remarks, that that Putin's cronies like to shop on the Champs-Élysées, that they like to buy up ski chalets in the Alps of Europe, that you'll encounter a large number of Russians in Switzerland. Of course, we know about how they've utilized the banking sector in the West. They bought real estate in London and elsewhere. But a lot of that gives off the impression of strength, of power, of capacity, when in fact it's a relatively hollow political economy because of the high levels of inequality and corruption structured around Putin. But one wouldn't know that when you're just meeting these relatively close to the regime styled wealthy people. And then the last point I would make related to that is when Westerners travel to Russia, their destinations tend to be really St. Petersburg or Moscow. And in a lot of these authoritarian systems, in the most extreme example, North Korea comes into mind as a real totalitarian state, the capital is often spared from a lot of the economic depravity that hits the rest of the country. So there's a great Twitter handle called, I think it's something like No Explanation Russia or something like that. I should know it if I'm going to raise it on the podcast. But irrespective, it's just random shots of Russia, and it gives you a real feel for Russia outside of the immediate confines of St. Petersburg or Moscow, where all looks well. But, you know, outside of that, outside of those two kind of great cities, there's a lot of problems.
Peter, you're exactly on point. Can't agree with you more. And I mean, it's not even just the sort of kleptocrats abroad, the oligarchs abroad purchasing property and frequenting ski resorts. I mean, they frequent high society, right? They go to great lengths to launder their reputations, to have access to leadership, and then eventually to co-opt leadership and find ways to offer people, you know, lucrative employment in their post-government career, or sometimes even when they are in government. I mean, you know, being so familiar with Austria as you are, you know that the previous Austrian government fell. Well, I guess the previous two previous now, but fell when the Freedom Party was, you know, caught on video essentially, you know, offering procurement contracts to, you know, a journalist masquerading as kind of like the daughter of a Russian oligarch, you know, saying like, oh yeah, we can, you know, get you 10% off the top or whatever, like as they kind of do. So, I mean, it's a really crazy kind of situation. Oliver Bulow, I think, has put this really well, that, you know, and I always give it to Oliver. I think it's somebody else that said this, and Oliver was quoting them, but there are no millionaires in Russia. There's only billionaires and everybody else, you know, and that's kind of how Russia's structured. So Putin's in trouble. Putin's created this system, and that makes it a problem for him.
The obvious question that begs then, and Peter, you raised this both in the, well, I don't know if it was you that raised it in the event, but you wrote about it in your article, was that the sanctions-based, you would expect the sanctions-based approach to be all the more effective because Putin's regime is so exposed outside of Russia. You know, as you say, all its economic power sort of lies in its ability to project it outside of the country itself. Well, if you step outside Moscow or St. Petersburg, you can't step outside them because your foot's in a pothole. Because they don't, you know, there's no money there. So that being the case, they're being so exposed. Why have sanctions sort of failed to constrain Putin's regime so far, do you think, given that they're so much more exposed even than many other kleptocratic regimes?
Well, I think the prize of Ukraine is so significant. The allure of winning over Ukraine, of splitting the country, of forging a corridor along the Black Sea coast, or maybe even enveloping Kyiv, just to walk through two or three of the scenarios that are being bandied about, that Putin is prepared to stomach significant economic sanctions should he be able to essentially freeze Ukraine's transition toward the West. So to date, I wouldn't say that economic sanctions have been commensurate to or exceeding Putin's political goals, which is necessary for them to act as an effective deterrent. A great example is the recent debate in Washington around Nord Stream 2, where there's been dueling legislation on the Hill. On the one hand, supported by Ted Cruz, a bill which is to levy sanctions against Nord Stream 2 now, and the other, crafted by Bob Menendez as a way to really, I think, rescue the Biden administration, which is in dire straits on this issue, saying that only in the event of an invasion will we be prepared to levy sanctions against Nord Stream 2, which then raises questions, of course, what a large-scale incursion means. The president had a press conference yesterday where he, for God knows what reason, mused aloud about this issue. But to date, I wouldn't say that that those sanctions have overwhelmed Russia. Putin has rebuilt a pretty strong currency reserve. He's beginning to toy with alternative payment systems with the Chinese. I'm not sure that he can clear a trade outside of dollar-denominated assets yet, but there is an attempt to build this up. And again, while Russia has steeled itself for confrontation with the West by trying to build a war economy, even if it is a relatively small economy by comparison, I mean, it's along the lines of a Spanish or Italian GDP, setting aside purchasing power parity issues where the Russians might be a little bit stronger. But it's a relatively small economy, while the West has remained focused on interdependence, in particular through energy, where it's really vulnerable. And that, of course, takes us back to Nord Stream 2.
Nord Stream 2, we have to talk, of course, at the moment about Germany and their role in this. You sort of raised this pull with the, you know, former officials sort of working, you know, for Putin's regime now, the highest former officials working for Putin's regime. You both know a lot more about German politics than I do. I'm lucky to have you both on the show today for that reason. But what is the deal within Germany? Why are they so reluctant to take a harder line as the UK is able to, as the US certainly does? Why are they so hell-bent on getting Nord Stream 2 built? Why do they refuse to recognize what is plain evidence in front of them about Putin's malign ambitions, about the corruption that's being channeled into the heart of Europe? What's wrong with Germany, basically, in a very non-eloquent, think-tanky sort of question?
I mean, this is somewhat crude, but maybe just to sum up the points, Paul, and you were making about Westerners working with the Russians, I think there are basically two categories. One would be what are outright apologists who were really, there is a head scratching element to it. And that would be like Gerhard Schröder, who has, I think, and it's a consensus position also in the German media and in large parts of the German political class that this has been a big misstep and has gone too far. But then there are also, just to take the Chinese example, who are also, of course, extending their tentacles into Europe, I think just globalists like, say, David Cameron, who's tried to fund a UK-China fund, a Sino-UK fund, or Dominic de Villepin, to name two prime ministers, one of the United Kingdom, the other one of France, who just work in alignment with the Chinese and sort of unwittingly, I think, help them expand their influence on the continent, not because they're bad actors and these former prime ministers are you know, deep in the pockets of the Chinese, but they're deep in the pockets of the Chinese because they're being funded by them. And so they're helping them expand their influence. So I think those are just two classes of sort of leadership actors who help advance Russian and Chinese objectives in Europe, just because I think those are the two most nefarious actors in Europe. As for the German-Russia relationship, for one, I think there is a great deal of respect for Russia as a civilization. This is a great peoples in the mind of Germany. Think of Tolstoy, Pushkin, and the literature that has emanated from there. And this is perhaps putting it a bit unfairly to the Germans, but when they look east, they really see Moscow as sort of an equal in a lot of ways. And while they view themselves as having a leadership role within the European Union, and so it needs to pull together the interests and the perspectives of its immediate Eastern European neighbors, the Baltics, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, etc., Russia is really a peer. Secondly, I would say that their vision or their view of victory in the Cold War is different than how we as Americans perceive it. We very much so think that Ronald Reagan and the American military buildup helped bankrupt the Soviet Union. We basically outmuscled them, outperformed them, and won the Cold War. The Germans, or a significant part of the German political class, believe that it was Wandel durch Handel, which means change through trade. It was dialogue, outreach, and basically interconnection and soft power offensives that ended up doing in the Soviets. There's a lot of evidence for that if one thinks back to the newly elected pontiff, Pope John Paul II, now St. Paul, John Paul II, traveling to Poland and the impact he had and so forth. But nonetheless, these are two very different point of views. And the implication or upshot, of course, is that the Germans are constantly trying to figure out new lanes for dialogue, outreach, and to talk to the Russians. The third is the legacy of the two world wars. When, to put it crudely, Germany is at war with Russia, bad things happen. Ergo, we should try to forge a positive relationship with them and engage in dialogue. That would be another component. And I guess I would just leave it there. I'd be interested to hear what Paul has to say.
Yeah, I mean, once again, I love what I'm hearing, and I got to say, I mean, I agree with all of that. I might just, you know, add a few more things, and maybe one broad important piece of all of this, and this is something that we've talked about, like, I think pretty much every episode of this podcast, and that's dictators and authoritarians, modern dictatorship doesn't invent new methods to go after us. It kind of exploits the cleavages that are already there. You know, it like looks for what are the problems inherent in this society and how can we manipulate them? And this is a particularly possible thing to do, and that was previously not, because you could just hire off through corruption people that know the society, right? So you get like, you know, lobbyists to work for you or former officials or whatever, and you actually have people that know where the cleavages are and where things hurt and how you can message to really hurt people badly and so on and so forth. So I think everything Peter's saying is about Germany is very correct. I think the only thing I might add is, you know, I kind of see it maybe a little bit more, a little bit less charitably, a little bit more cynically, that, you know, I think that Germany does view itself as a great power. I think that's sometimes the Second World War is now even used as kind of an excuse not to engage in things they don't want to engage in. I think we kind of saw this with, I think this was very clearly kind of made when the president of Germany, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, basically said we have to do Nord Stream 2 because we owe the Russians for crimes committed in World War II, which is, you know, just such a crazy thing to say when you consider that, you know, the crimes committed against Ukrainians, right? I mean, who is in the middle here? It's Ukrainians, you know? So I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think that there's a lot of, to what Peter was saying, I mean, that when they look east, they see Moscow and it's, you know, a great civilization. It's also, they see a reflection of themselves in a sense. They kind of see Moscow runs Eurasia and we run Europe. And then this kind of goes into a, like, well, and why does America get to be in here? Why can't America just get out of our backyard? Let us run things around here, you know? So I think that, you know, like, there's another fella that Peter probably knows, Jamie Kirchick, who does a lot of thinking about Germany in particular. And he, I think, did a pretty good job at kind of explaining, you know, the dueling trends of German politics is like this idea of, you know, Westbindung or binding to the West versus, you know, the Ostpolitik, which, you know, again, like the Eastern policy is what that means. But what it really means is kind of like this change through trade, like always engage, always dialogue kind of thing. And I do feel that at least recently, and there's an excellent Politico article today by Matthew Karnichnik and Politico called Germany's Pivot from America, that I think has a lot of truth in it about, you know, this sort of part of the German mind. And again, I want to emphasize that it's possible for Germany to be both very, very, very pro-America and very, very, very anti-America. I think both of these, just like in our own society, we can have two conflicting ideas that exist at the same time, but then, you know, disinformation, dictators, whatever, come in and try to emphasize one side over the other, exploit one side over the other. And I think that that's what's happened.
The other point I would make, just as a supplement to Paul's argument, is that no country has had a better post-Cold War period than Germany, arguably anywhere in the world. And so Germany is very much so interested in preserving the status quo. It does not want to see a Cold War era standoff between East and West. It does not want to see a world of geopolitical rivalry between the Far East, or China in particular, and the United States, with Europe caught in between. It thrived on globalization. Its entire economy is structured to export goods. And so it's naturally inclined to try to tamp down tension with any burgeoning revisionist actor like Russia for the sake of preserving the position it's acquired in the global system over the past several decades. And then the other thing I would just say is that Germany does not have a strategic culture the way the United States or, say, France does. If you watch a lot of German television or their documentaries or read the German press, there's a and it, this applies, I'd say, in particular to think tanks and to academics. There's a great deal of anthropologic and technocratic knowledge about the world, and it extends across Eurasia. So the Germans have these, anywhere you look in Eurasia, somewhere an expat who will then appear on a documentary to talk about the specifics of, say, living in Baku, Azerbaijan, or what's it like to export goods to Bangkok, Thailand, where they've been living for 15 years. And these are often featured in German media and press. So it's sort of an anthropologically sympathetic view of the rest of the world, and they get into very technocratic policy prescriptions. Whereas in the US, and I'd argue this is true in the Anglosphere writ large, and it's also true in France, there's much more of an emphasis on strategic debate, right? Who is on the right side? Who is on the wrong side? How we must contest, how we must compete, how we must push back against revisionism or against bad behavior. And you don't see that quite as much. And so the Germans, who are also obsessed with academic titles and hierarchy in a lot of respects, have these very academic debates. And there really is only an incipient think tank culture funded in large part by the German state, which means then there aren't really as rigorous and aggressive attacks on, say, German foreign policy making as you might expect and as there is in the US context, have these very esoteric debates amongst themselves about, you know, which lever of development aid in Mali might be more successful than, say, which other lever. And that's just that's a very different attitude and does not lend itself towards a muscular foreign policy to take on Vladimir Putin and the Russians.
Right. And it also doesn't lend itself to changing course from kind of the established wisdom, whatever it is. In this case, as you say, the kind of change through trade doctrine. And I guess, you know, I totally agree with Peter. I think both of us are kind of explaining different sides of the same phenomenon. And I guess my frustration often is that if Germany, I guess it's kind of that classic, almost American frustration of you're so powerful and so influential, and you're so powerful and so influential because you've been able to enjoy the fruits of a democratic international order. So when are you going to put your power on the line to defend that order? And I guess that's kind of the, I think a lot of the frustration I hear with Germany generally, and I think that's a lot what you hear even out of Ukraine, is like we want what you have and we're fighting for what you have, so why can't you help us with it?
There's a major institute, I don't remember the name of the organization, it might be somebody like Pew, but again, I'm just throwing out a guess, that ranks every year based on polling the most admired countries in the world. And Germany consistently ranks at the very, very top. And it's very proud of that. Now, that does suggest that, you know, German goods are renowned for their excellence. German products tend to be great. And that living in Germany, something like a social democratic panacea in a lot of respects, people view Germany as a place, if they're fleeing the Middle East, that they'd like to make it to. But it also suggests, which is what I think you're saying, Paul, that Germany does not take difficult decisions that might alienate some peoples, right? It doesn't really involve itself in questions like how to punish Bashar al-Assad for using chemical weapons against his own people. It doesn't really involve itself in some of these hard power choices that Washington has to make, and which invariably makes one somewhat unpopular. So it's been able to elide those responsibilities while enjoying the fruits of the international system. And I'm hypothesizing that we're beginning to reach the end of that strategy, because I'm not sure it'll be viable all that much longer, which returns us, I guess, to Ukraine.
Yeah. And I guess I just want to, always good to have a little quote in here, but you know, it's a Franklin Roosevelt, not Theodore Roosevelt, who I'm always quoting on the podcast, but the other Roosevelt, you know, I ask you to judge me by the enemies I have made. And I think that that's a really important thing, that the fact that Germany is constantly ranked as like most beloved is exactly what you're saying, Peter. You know, to take a stand in the world, to defend values, to protect democracy, you're going to make some enemies. It's inevitable, you know, and if you're unwilling to do that, then you're going to lose it.
And the other thing that sort of springs to mind just in recent years is the way that Germany's domestic energy policy has rendered it more maybe vulnerable and dependent on external sources as the energy crisis has hit. You know, they've They tried to phase out nuclear power, which is kind of essential for providing any country with a sort of baseline, a developed country with a baseline supply. You know, they've chosen to try and depend on, you know, what are still relatively unproven and expensive, you know, technologies, energy and solar, rather than trying to sort of use cleaner fossil fuels. Do you think that Germany itself is vulnerable to these energy things in the way some of the smaller European countries are as well? Does that factor in?
Yes, I think so. You could argue that Fukushima and subsequent decision by Angela Merkel to get out of nuclear power contributed to Russia's rise as a major regional power. It was already one back then, but it's really helped strengthen, I think, the Russian position vis-a-vis Europe. And that's in part why the Germans are so adamant on Nord Stream 2, is they want to secure their energy supplies as a bridging energy to this green future, which they dream of, but I'm not sure will arrive quite the way that they hope it will, neither arriving soon enough nor, you know, in big enough scope to power what is a major industrial economy. So yes, that's, I think, a big part of the problem. Of course, the difference between the Eastern European states and Germany is that Nord Stream will pump gas directly to Germany. And so the fear that the Eastern European states have is that the Russians can essentially calibrate gas flows, so it will be enough to supply Germany and Northwestern Europe, but not enough for onward flow through the west to east interconnectors that would, in the event of a crisis, if the Russians shut down both Yamal and Brotherhood, the Polish and the Ukrainian pipelines, leave them in Eastern Europe high and dry. And by the way, because Nord Stream 2 will bring gas directly to Germany, those west to east interconnectors will probably be flooded with Russian gas, which will create disincentives for further investment in interconnectors and new technologies and all the rest. And one could easily see a bifurcation in the European energy system where the relatively diverse northwestern part of Europe, including Germany and others, will be really on a different energy system and grid than the relatively dependent Eastern Europeans, which is what on Russia, which is what Putin and his regime, of course, are aiming at. So that's another side product of this decision to get out of nuclear and to really rely on gas as a way of getting them to these new technology. I mean, the statistics on what just like say a major company like ThyssenKrupp uses it on an annual basis. I mean, you can't build enough windmills to power a steel operation like ThyssenKrupp. So these are major dilemmas for the Germans, and they're just now working through them.
Oh, yeah, I just thought it was interesting. I just wanted to bring it, but as you say, we should return to Ukraine. And I'm not hearing, you know, I'm also thinking of the statement by the French president yesterday that, you know, Europe should be seeking its own security arrangements with Russia, independent of those of the US. So I'm not hearing an amazing prospect for a sort of robust European response to whatever may happen in the coming days. That sort of raises the question as we move on to your sort of US policy options. Do we need the Europeans to impose serious costs or serious deterrence on the Russian regime for any aggression towards Ukraine? Paul, do you think we need the Europeans to go along, or will US sanctions, perhaps US military power if needed, is that enough, along with perhaps the UK, which has also, as you mentioned, acquitted itself very well in the past few days.
Right. Yeah. And that's been really impressive. And I guess it isn't all about kind of pure power statistics, you know, stuff like that. And I think that we sort of know, I mean, like, that's kind of the whole thing about corruption as an asymmetric weapon is precisely that, you know, it's not about pure power. You know, it's not he who has the greater economy wins. I mean, it's clearly not, you know. So, I mean, in a sense, when it comes to sanctions, America can just go. Like, I mean, the US dollar is so powerful, you know, and I honestly, I mean, we've been talking about, so, you know, a lot about de-swifting as recent. And you know, for those who don't know, for the podcast listeners, SWIFT is basically just an exchange platform for all banks. All banks exchange information via SWIFT. It's the Society of Worldwide International Financial Transactions or something like that. But in any case, you know, we've been talking about that, and the worry is if you took Russia off that, if you said Russia no longer has access to that, well, then they might, you know, create their own alternative system. Okay. I mean, like, you know, they've got something in place to cushion the impact of that. They could, you know, at one point back in 2014, you know, when they occupied Crimea, if we did it then, their banks wouldn't have even been able to talk to one another because they were all using SWIFT, right? So even domestically, they wouldn't be able to. Now they've got like a domestic platform, so it wouldn't be as bad, but it would still be very devastating, right? You know, if we sanctioned all the oligarchs, forced them to live in Russia, you know, we could do that because even if the Europeans didn't go along with us, you know, you still can't spend your money in like France or Germany because the USA has sanctioned you, unless you're, of course, you know, using anonymous shell companies and enablers and all sorts of stuff we've talked about on this podcast about like, you know, how you can go through it. So you can't just sanction. You also need to go after the anonymous financial mechanisms that let you kind of obfuscate financial flows. But at the end of the day, American financial power can be used on its own. The bigger question is like, you know, if we use it and then the French and Germans are like, ah, oh, why did you use it? You know, you're hurting us. Well, we've been there before. We were there with Deripaska, right? And basically what happened is we sanctioned Deripaska rightfully because he's a huge, huge, huge problem. And then all our allies complained and they said, oh, you just sanctioned 70% of the aluminum market. You can't do this, blah-de-blah-de-blah. You know, and Deripaska got Lord Baker, you know, sitting guy in the House of Lords or whatever, and a whole lobbying, whatever, to come over to America and basically get us to remove the kind of knock-on sanctions on Deripaska's companies. So, I mean, having your allies on board is worth it if you can get there. It should never be like the deciding factor because you don't want to do a lowest common denominator foreign policy. But I really do think from a normative narrative perspective, it would be a lot nicer if the West were united, which it's not.
I would defer to Paul on that. Those experts on sanctions whom I trust say that more or less the United States, perhaps in close cooperation with the United Kingdom, would be able to do 75 to 80% of the damage if it had the entire European Union coordinated and meshed up with the US-UK move. So probably economic sanctions could achieve a similar effect or close to as a fully fledged Western, meaning European American, sanction force. My concern is that this is the wrong domain on the Ukraine crisis. That basically we have signaled to Vladimir Putin that we are not going to accede to his core political demands, at least as they've been made over the past several weeks, but simultaneously have also taken U.S. ground troops off the table and have been somewhat hesitant in the types of systems that we've supplied the Ukrainians with. That, to me, is an invitation for war because it signals, on the one hand, that we're not going to meet Putin's demands, but on the other hand, we're also not going to stop him if he attempts to achieve them. Yes, sanctions would matter. They'd be serious. They'd be impactful. But as I said at the outset, I think Ukraine is such a prize. It would also raise Russia's industrial capacity. It would do a great deal for Vladimir Putin and for Russia's strategic position in the world that they might be willing to stomach that. So while the White House says that it is offering both carrots and sticks, carrots being an arms control negotiation, sticks being economic sanctions, what I fear the Russians are hearing is, you want to accede to these outlandish demands, basically the dissolution of the European Security Order, but you're also unwilling to really fight us if we go for it. And so that to me leads me to conclude that we could very well be facing a military conflict in the coming weeks and months.
I think that you're correct. I think you need to do even more than the harshest possible sanctions at this point, and I think you need to do them right now. I guess I'm not entirely decided whether, you know, Putin thinks these things are baked in or whether he just thinks they're not going to happen. Because when you look at his actual occupation of Crimea and then, you know, invasion of the Eastern Donbass, I mean, our response to that was very lackluster, you know, and I mean, it's been lackluster. You know, we still have a lot of Russian oligarchs and influence figures operating all over the West. You know, I mean, what happened after, you know, the attempted Sergei Skripal assassination? What happened after the assassination in Berlin? You know, what happened after, you know, it's been continuous without any consequences. So I think you know, if there is a calculation out there, it's that even the sanctions might not be serious. And I'd almost hope the situation is more that you know, he's thinking the situation, the sanctions aren't serious, then he's thinking the sanctions are baked in. Because, you know, I mean, if it's baked in, then it seems almost inevitable that this is going to happen. Whereas if it's thinking that the sanctions aren't serious or aren't real, then we could do it and potentially stop it.
I like the idea that, you know, our colleague, I think he spoke about it at your event, Peter, again, to reference that, but Marshall Billingsley has put forward, well, let's sort of call his bluff on that front a little by releasing the specific targets of what we would hit with sanctions, because they would go way beyond, you know, the current, you know, objective, which is to target, you know, obviously anyone doing anything in relation to those occupied areas of Ukraine, but also the military companies, suppliers, groups, you know, and the officials involved in that. Whereas, like, you know, this would be really, they call it like the nuclear option, but we would move from that very limited approach to measures that would undoubtedly would affect the Russian people very, very seriously and severely. And so, you know, the way to create the ripple that could sort of upset Putin's boat a little before the full sort of wave of those sanctions would be to release the names of the banks and other institutions that we would go after. So I really like that idea. I think that's one way that you could sort of send a very scary shot across the bow, because then, you know, if there are repercussions for the Russian people, that's when Putin starts to have to think about, you know, problems on the streets at home. And, you know, the Russian people have proved time and again that they're prepared to hit the streets in their thousands when something, you know, like this happens, something far less severe than this happens. And, you know, I wonder if Putin would have quite such a stomach for him for starting a war in Ukraine, you know, if many more thousands of people were on the streets outside right outside the Kremlin, which they presumably would be if they suddenly couldn't get any money out of the bank, to, you know, which is already hard enough for many Russians.
I think that's right. And I also think you could pair that with just straight throwing the entire, you know, oligarchy out of the West now. You know, you can go ahead and sanction them. You can investigate them. You can, you know, seize what assets you can and, you know, under legal means and so on and so forth, you know. And I, because again, I think this calculation, this balancing act that Putin has to do to maintain power, we need to disrupt it, you know. And one way to disrupt it is to, you know, kind of, as you say, Nate, like, you know, I mean, he's doing this in part because he needs the people to have an external enemy. So, you know, making that costly. But another piece of disrupting it is making his elites actually have to live in the system they've made. And that's kind of the big thing for me is, I mean, if you sent all the oligarchs home and didn't allow them to hang in the West anymore, then they will begin to rethink this bargain that they have with Putin, which is basically, we'll support you and run everything and do all the elite stuff you need us to do, you know, in exchange for not actually having to live under you or hold any of our assets under you and, or, you know, and so on and so forth. It gives them a level of distance, you know, and almost leverage and almost kind of like a, you know, escape button. You know, so he like Saul Abramovich recently, you know, get citizenship in Portugal, right? Because of his Sephardic Jewish roots. Congratulations, Roman Abramovich, you know, and probably $100 million too. But again, it's that kind of like, well, if it goes bad, I need to get out of here.
You know? One of the more popular suggestions, US sanctions often don't go down well overseas, of course. They're not understood, the reasons for them. And, you know, the example that we brought up earlier of Deripaska, when they had to close a steel factory in Ireland or whatever it was, of course, the workers didn't understand why they were being fired. They just blamed the US because, you know, this was an action the US had taken. With Abramovich, this is a slightly facile, you know, and way to sort of end a serious discussion, but the idea of sanctioning Chelsea Football Club is wildly popular in the United Kingdom. would actually be a huge PR problem, you know, for, you know, that would really elevate people's understanding of, you know, that's a way to get public awareness across Europe. Raised, I think, about the way that the Kremlin does business. But I guess just to sort of finish off, maybe just a few final thoughts from you both. And what, you know, if you were sitting in the White House right now with President Biden, what are the sort of, it's a bit facile, but sort of like the top three things that the US should be doing that we're not doing right now. What would you like to see more of? I think we've sort of talked about a lot of that right throughout the podcast. But what are the sort of top two or three things that, you know, we need to do right now to stop this happening?
Well, not to be flippant, but I would just urge the president to stay on a teleprompter and to talk about Build Back Better rather than offering musings about matters of war and peace, which end up requiring cleanup the next minute from his spokesperson and cause people in Kiev to go, as I think one journalist put it, nuclear in just apoplectic rage that the president would say something like that. So one would be more discipline from the president. This isn't the first time this has happened. Think back to the Taiwan issue where the White House has also had to issue clarifications, I think at least on one occasion, but I can remember at least two instances in which he's gotten out over his skis on an issue where he did not intend to go. Secondly, I would do everything I can in short order to steel Ukraine against large-scale military attack. And then thirdly, I would sync up with the Europeans as much as possible and publicize, as you put it, a lot of the steps that one can take in coordination with your allies to really shift Putin's cost calculus and risk calculus.
Paul, you want to kick the oligarchs out? What?
Yeah, no, I mean, crack the whip right now. You know, don't wait. You know, that's to me, it's a demonstration of resolve is very important because we've not shown very much of that over a very long period of time. So kind of the demonstration that you can't push us around like this is pretty important at this point. I'd also get creative and think about, like, you know, what else do we have in our arsenal? You know, like what other tricks have we been holding on to, you know, and think about what can be done from that perspective. I kind of think we kind of default to sort of sanctions or economic warfare or something like that, but or even military, but there's obviously like a lot of other stuff that could be done, you know, and we should be considering that kind of stuff and what else. And then I've always kind of thought, sanctions and that kind of thing need to be matched with almost a, you know, real, attempt to speak with and appeal to the Russian people, because the Russian people have, you know, also been very serious victims of the Putin regime. And, you know, I've thought that could take the form of special visas. I've thought it could take the form of scholarships. I thought it could take the form of whatever. But I think it's, you know, being able to make these appeals and deconstruct this kind of narrative of NATO is the bad guy and so on and so forth is extremely important because, you know, I never want to lose sight of the fact that there are, you know, really amazing Russians working to create a democratic Russia or a human rights respecting Russia. And it doesn't have to be this way, you know, and so much of it is because we've allowed this kind of dirty money into the West. So let's push that out and let's, you know, make that appeal to the Russian people.
Well, I just realized we're sort of running slightly over time. I had the clock on my laptop obscured, so I didn't realize how long I've detained you, Peter and Paul. So I'd just like to thank you both for your time today and insights. Part of the reason I lost track of time, it was just so fascinating, and I learned a lot, especially about Germany, which I didn't expect to spend so time on, but I was sort of greedy there because I was interested to learn more from you both, and I really did. So I'm sure we'll be returning to this topic next week, at least in part, hopefully. Not with bad news, but if so, we may drag you back on, Peter, to talk about it again. But thank you both for this week, and we'll see you again, all our listeners, next week on Making a Killing.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Making a Killing, the podcast from Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative on how corruption is reshaping global politics. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to subscribe and share with your friends. You can also give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. That really helps get the word around. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.